Okay, so I'm giving this talk at the wrong moment. It was meant to be a provocation to discussion on issues I've been working on and kind of current image I have of the situation of mass, neutrinos, CP, and so on. And of course, when I came in, I was terribly jet-lagged and I had about 10 seconds to tell the title of my seminar, which I couldn't do in 10 seconds. So it came a bit later, and I hope it's not too late. So you have possible titles here, a sampler, a medley, which means it will be disorganized, but I will give you a table of contents at the end. So okay. You can check how long you slept in the middle. Okay. Let me first try to gather some ideas. And well, I'm not completely focused on neutrinos, of course, but I think the main problems we are still confronted with, and it's just completely standard to say that, is the issue of mass. Well, gauge we understand in some way that brings us some nice unification of interactions, but the mass sector we don't understand. And in a related way, the CP violation we don't understand. You prefer? Oh, yeah, okay. I could use the pointer if I find it. Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah, just in the trajectory, right? It's fine. Okay. So the gauge part we understand, and one of the main points I want to make, and which is now, I think, a well-made point, is that gauge is CP violating. We know that gauge interactions essentially relate left-handed fermions to left-handed or right-handed to right-handed, but they also link right-handed antifermions to right-handed antifermions. If you do the game, you see, well, we can go in detail through it, but I think in this audience it's not necessary. CP is actually the natural symmetry of gauge interactions if you do not include mass. You might think anomalies would break it, but actually even anomalies don't break it as long as you don't have mass, because you can essentially rotate away the anomalies. So the sector which we have to spend our energy on is mass and is also CP violation. And then we have another level of complexity here, is that when we deal with neutrinos, we don't not only have to understand why they have masses, but why their masses are small. And that will be a little bit the kind of journey we are going to go through. So what is mass? I'll try to use this in this way. Okay. Maybe I should put my slides on this side. See, I'm totally blinded. Okay. Okay, how could we put mass in a gauge theory? Well, the simplest way would be, if you want a mass term, you put a mass term. But that means that the theory immediately becomes vector-like, which we don't observe it to be, and it will also mean that multiplets have to be degenerate. Well, this is not a completely excluded, it's at first sight it is excluded, but this idea may come back and we'll just see it later. We can think of mass as a different thing, as in a way, in a dispersion relation, the minimal energy that a particle can have. But this minimum is only defined after we choose the vacuum. If I look at very high temperature, quarks, for example, would be massless because there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking yet, and therefore, this notion is kind of a time-dependent notion to know what is the mass of the particle. So maybe a better way to think of mass is to think of mass as a left-right transition, because the coupling then of quarks to scalars would be some example of such left-right transition, and I would not be dependent upon the phase transition. But mass as a left-right transition is intrinsically a 3 plus 1 dimension concept, because left-handed and right-handed fermions are only defined for odd number of spatial dimensions. So if I go in five dimensions, for example, I can just forget about that. So even getting a tag on the issue of mass is not all that simple. Then we will have to deal with Majorana masses. Well, I'll mention it briefly below. Of course, we can consider all masses to be Majorana, and Dirac is just a special case of it, but I'll comment on this a little bit later. Now, we will also deal, another possibility is to see mass in our four-dimensional world as just a reflection of excitation in extra dimensions, and those excited modes give me some kind of kinetic energy in the extra dimensions, which is seen as mass. And this is one possibility. But first, I would like to stop a second and, in this line of thinking, come back to the question, is mass a low energy phenomenon, as we tend to believe it is? Well, thinking of right-handed Majorana neutrinos, we may have the opposite idea. And indeed, I think there is a very interesting model, which was, I think, really more than revived by Ernest Ma, and which essentially, you correct me if I'm wrong, separates the issue of chiral symmetry breaking from the idea of group breaking. In this model, let's say to each part, well, I'm paraphrasing what Ernest Ma has been doing. I'm actually constructing the model which he is alluding to in his paper. In this model, to each kind of particle, low energy particle, we associate a high energy particle, but this high energy particle has the same name, but is a singlet under the gauge group. So it just shares the same name, but I need to have such degree of liberty, of freedom. Particle is vector-like, that means it has a high mass, and the chiral symmetry breaking is here something like an original sin. It is not something which happens at low energy, and it transfers into masses for the low energy particles simply by the group breaking. So we have a vacuum expectation value here, which generates a transition. The group quantum numbers are carried both by the particle here and by the scalar boson, the Brout-Englert-Higgs boson, which would be there. And the same thing, for example, on the right-handed side. So in this area, we get for all particles something which is very reminiscent of the seesaw mechanism, but now it's placed for all particles. And it has the advantage, I think, to separate fairly well those two issues of chiral symmetry breaking on one side and on group breaking.
It's called the universal seesaw, right?
Was in a different context.
Yeah. But the idea, well, anyway, the idea is that you don't even have to know what is in between.
This is your paper.
Yeah. You just have the group symmetry breaking to the origin of mass terms. So all mass terms are dimension five operators. All mass terms are dimension five. So that is indication that they come from some new physics at a high scale.
And that's only the simplest realization. Now, I think this would deserve to be explored further now in terms of axion phenomenology, and there is a large number of questions which could be raised again in this framework. I tell you, this is just an invitation for discussion. Well, this was a side remark, but I think it is of interest. Okay, let me go through one more step. Neutrino mass. Well, let's go directly to the difficult case and understand why they are so small, or that small. Well, the obvious answer, we just mentioned it, is a seesaw mechanism. But that, I will keep you waiting for a little while to do it. I have only six slides, you know, numbered one through six, and some sub-slides. Okay, this is one possibility. The other possibility I'm going to discuss here, this is somewhat older work we did with Troitsky and Libanov, is to find the origin of the neutrino mass in the MSSM, the minimal supersymmetric model. I'm not a great fan of the minimal supersymmetric model. I think it definitely lacks a singlet. But let's see what happens in that case. And, well, for once I'll do this. I hate to do that, but let's start with some local style advertisement. Okay, so this is a way to get a low neutrino mass. This model is totally 100% neurite free. I don't know what you mean 100% free, but okay. It has also absolutely no particle added, and there is a fine print. That means it has, you look at the back of the box usually, or the bottom of the can, and that means no particle beyond all the MSSM jungle, of course, which is quite a lot of particles. But apart from that, really, you don't add any hypothesis. Well, a little bit. You are doing some gravity-mediated supersymmetry breaking. That means that you have an F term which translates the hidden sector, and the effect is mediated via gravity with a typical mass of order 10 to 19 GeVs. Usually you just keep the F over M term, and that gives you the mass of the scalar partners, of squarks and so on. But here we are just going one step further. Has no bad consequences because this term is extremely small. So we know gravity is not renormalizable, but anyway, we play the game. And this induces a term like this one. Well, if you want to read it, this is the Slepton doublet. This is one of the scalar Brautangler Higgs particles, one of the two in the game. And this is just making sure the thing is an SU2 invariant. And squaring it, this is R parity conserving. So there's not even R parity violation. Really, garden variety model, completely usual. You just go through it. That means you have a vertex like this, which is nutil HH. Nutil, remember, are scalars. I've put arrows because that's the way you have to do it in the MSSM, but they are scalars for the moment. And I have to transfer this to the fermion sector. So how do I do this? Well, just following my nose. There's no problem doing that. And we generate this graph. So you have the interaction we know. It will develop vacuum expectation values as we know. And here I build a triangle with the neutrino outside. The key ingredient is having here the zeno, or whatever neutralino particles are involved. And of course, the key ingredient to get the chirality, well, the lepton number flip, if you want, is to have here the Majorana mass of the zeno, which is anyway present in the MSSM. So in this way, we generate a mass. And guess what? The natural order of magnitude of this mass is 10 to the minus 3 EV. And there is no trick. Yeah? Well, the first term is lepton breaking. This term is lepton breaking. This term is R parity conserving, but, sorry? Yeah, it is lepton breaking. Well, this is one possible term. There are a few other possible terms, but not so many, and it's really, well, we can look at the paper. We have explored it at length. No, I'm not going to go into details. I'm just telling you this is a motivation for thought. It's just that you can check then that at next orders you don't get any diversion contribution, which would force you to put a counter term by hand and so on. So it's essentially safe, and I don't think there is much.
But here also, R parity is broken.
No.
It is, because Gaijinos break R parity.
No.
Yes, Gaijinos.
This can be a pure Gaijino.
Yes.
A pure Zeno.
Yes, you see the Gaijinos, the fact that they have mass, they will break R parity.
No.
R
parity. R parity is not broken.
Yeah, it's not broken because the square term.
Yes.
Is even.
Is even.
You mean the discrete, the subgroup.
But the subgroup.
Subgroup. Yeah, yeah. R parity. R parity.
Okay.
I didn't say okay. R parity.
Yeah,
just the R parity, not the symmetry. Not R symmetry, no.
R symmety is broken by that term already.
Of course, already by the first term, yes. Or by anything, but the R parity is conserved. Well, apparent is one more ugly thing in the MSSM, but okay, sorry for that. Well, PFI is not around. Well, but he can listen to this on TV. So. Okay. So this is one first possibility to do it without anything. And by the way, I mentioned it on the previous slide. The mass you get that way is completely unrelated to the charged lepton masses. Which is weird.
All the neutrinos have the same mass.
That you can decide by, you know, this LH term is, you have to introduce for each family. And so there is no prescription coming in this. It's just a generic order of magnitude you can get in this game. Okay, just to mention it, that we don't absolutely need a right-handed neutrino. Well, another way to do it is within the standard model to just put a triplet, of course, we know it. And this is well known also in left-right models where you had a right-handed triplet. It's not bothersome if you put a few percent of the vacuum expectation value on the triplet. And this relation is now in the standard model. You have two scalars which get vacuum expectation values. There are two SU2 doublets. And you have the triplet there. You get again one of those CISO relations. And this is now, I understand, merchandise under the type 2 CISO mechanism. Essentially, well, this is pretty obvious. Okay. Now, next possibility is coupling to large extra dimensions. And what I want to go a little bit on this, coupling to extra dimensions. Of course, this has been a very much trodden path. But I want to do it to clarify one thing, is the kind of oscillations you get there. Well, of course, this possibility, which was very exciting at one moment before K2K and before SNOW, is now markedly less interesting. Still, there is some room for it, and it's maybe worth exploring the nature of those extra dimension oscillations. Do I need this? No, I will not need this slide anymore. Oh, I will probably go through it. Okay. Now, neutrino and extra dimensions, let me just put the scenery. Well, if you want to get the kind of suppression we in the mass, you have to take a much higher slide. Okay, let's imagine we have some compact extra dimension here, y. Let's imagine that the right-handed neutrinos, and it's a bit more complex than that because they are actually left and right-handed, but I'm simplifying the issue, are free to roam this extra dimension, while all neutrinos, left-handed, which are linked to gauge symmetry, are confined on the membrane, and this membrane should have a width which is less than 1 TeV minus 1. Otherwise, this is incompatible with what we know about gauge interactions. For example, we know that QED is valid to a better to this kind of distance, so we are bound to have this thickness. In that way, you find very quickly that the mass is suppressed. Well, it's difficult to discuss the mass in 5 dimensions, but say with respect to your expectation when you go to 4 dimensions, the mass is suppressed by the ratio of those dimensions, of those sizes. And therefore, you can indeed get a very small mass. Not only do you get a very small mass, but you get also some mixing between not only the first state here, but also the Kaluza-Klein excitations, of which I only drew the first one. This mixing is measured by, well, when you have kind of a matrix to mix the states, the Kaluza-Klein states have mass 1 over r, the fundamental neutrino has a mass of order m, and it's clearly when the two masses start to be of the same order that the mixing will be large, and if you have a whole finely split tower of Kaluza-Klein states, you will get a lot of mixing. So this is the parameter dictating the mixing. Now, we have a very different situation from what we know in 4 dimensions, because instead of having oscillations with 1, maybe 2 states when we are really courageous, some people have considered even 4, well, they mean mixing with 3 states, well, we now get mixing with hundreds of modes. And what does that mean? Well, if psi is less than 1, I'm making some kind of impressionist, well, it's, the drawing is not very good. But let's imagine this is the extra dimensions that I visualize. I put my fifth dimension, I do a sixth dimensional plot, if you want. This is ordinary space. This is the fifth dimension, and I draw it as being a compactified, so it's a cylinder. And you see that I'm mixing into various modes. Now, if those modes are few and they are harmonic, it means that at some time, the thing will come back in tune. And therefore, I will see real oscillations with my all of my neutrinos returning at some moment together. This is what happens if psi is small. If the mixing is small, I have only one or two modes, and the situation is almost harmonic. If I get a large psi, then I'm mixing into a large number of states, and it is not harmonic on top of it, and the probability that they all return together becomes extremely small. Moreover, when a significant number of them come back together, it makes a very sharp needle because the space where they can come back together is very small. So we get very strange oscillations. This was not really detailed too much at the time, that's why I want to go through it. And these are the patterns I'm getting.
Is it like oscillating into a sterile?
It is like oscillating into many steriles. This is what it gives you. So you have the usual logarithmic scale for the distance here, in terms of r. You have the various mixings, and you see that in the first case, we get some mixing here, and you can see that a few modes are dominating. If I go to larger and larger psi, not only does my flux disappear completely, almost completely, but also I get huge fluctuations, which are, of course, not really observable, because any experiment or any emission situation will take an average over those peaks. But it's getting completely chaotic. No, it's not oscillation because you can get it to disappear completely. When you take the average here, the average is essentially zero. If you take psi equals 3, you see what is left. This is the survivor probability. If you oscillate into a sterile, you come back. So you get 50%, right? Imagine you have a total oscillation, the maximum oscillation into a sterile, you still get 50% of your neutrinos left. Here, you get zero. You can get zero.
So all of these curves go back up to one if I go to
small enough? Yeah, if you go to small enough, it's like right.
Is it just because there are many
particles
which they oscillate?
Many particles.
You get one half if you have two species, you get one third maximum.
Yeah, okay, but even if they were harmonic, if the thing would be harmonic, like many people have done the analysis by simplifying and assuming the modes were harmonic, in this case you would get huge spikes because they would come back together. Well, here they don't come back together. And that's the anharmonicity which is adding to it. And therefore, if you do the study a bit more carefully, this is what I wanted to show, and this is how you lead.
So you think if you looked at different detector distances, and you see that it's zero.
Yeah. Well, until you had K2K and snow, you could say that all the data were described by disappearance of half the neutrinos. So this was a very interesting possibility. I'm mentioning it. Okay. So now if you look at psi, what you get here is the survival probability at large distance or for large detector, and for, if possibly for large detector, it means averaging. You see that probability goes down very quickly. And here is the fluctuation of that probability over space.
This large psi part, does it not look like decay also? Can you distinguish it from decay of the neutrino?
The neutrino is not decaying, it's disappearing into extra dimensions. Yeah, it would be like a decay. But this is just, this is just the decay as a function of the mixing. So this is not a special spatial function. So you see that we could actually still, for the moment, let me come to the punchline. Well, no punchline, but the sad conclusion. For the moment, all we could do is play on the uncertainty on the boron and accept 20%. That means psi equals 0.4, which is not too bad, actually. So we can still accept a 20% disappearance of neutrinos because we don't know the boron flux from the sun to 20%. And this psi equals 0.4 would still be feasible. But psi above 1 is completely out of the question.
Sorry. Can I extend the active neutrinos are mixing with these higher dimensional
yes.
neutrinos? Does that mean that when there's 40% fewer active neutrinos, there's 40% of the sterile type neutrinos?
Yeah.
So the total energy is conserved.
Yes, but part of the energy is not observable.
Yeah,
the energy is conserved.
So, for example, in the early, maybe you'll say something about it, but in the early universe, if I had this operative, I don't get fewer than 3 neutrinos. It's just that the active ones may disappear, but the energy density, the energy would stay the same?
I think you are right. I should come back to you after thinking a little bit of what happens with extra dimensions, because it's not clear how the evolution would go there.
Yeah.
But because they are spending time in extra, you know, the phase space is a bit different. But say at sufficiently low temperature, you could see it as extra species of neutral neutrinos, or of sterile neutrinos, which are contributing, of course, to the expansion of the universe.
So you might have a situation where some of the electron neutrinos disappear, which might be a bad thing, but the total energy density might stay the same.
Stay. And actually, we can also generate oscillations in this mechanism. That's what we had suggested, a very minimal mechanism, by coupling both nu E and nu mu to the bulk here. I'm just mentioning it for the moment. And that means that one combination disappears, the one which couples to the bulk. The other stays, and therefore you get a total mixing between the other two states.
This question about the early universe, I don't know what happens to the general relativity in the presence of extra dimensions.
No, but presumably at the time Gary is mentioning, we are in 4 dimensions. You are concerned with the...
You're concerned with the low energy,
yeah, yeah, so concerned with nucleosynthesis, probably.
Yeah, I'm concerned with MEV.
Yeah, cool stuff. Cool stuff.
The cool stuff.
The cool rock.
Hey, there you go. I haven't heard that
phrase. Is my understanding correct that in this case what happens is that if you fix the extra dimension size, then what's going on is that you effectively have a component which is evolved like dark radiation, which is not observable, but mm-hmm.
it's, yeah, in some way, yes. Now, this model has not been re-explored. I would say there was one big argument. I should mention it right now, but I have other subjects to cover, so we can come back later. I can skip some subjects, too. There was one big reproach made, criticism made of this kind of approach, is that in supernovae, because you have so many states to oscillate to, essentially the energy would be lost in sterile neutrino in supernovae, would still be there for gravitation, but would be useless to make the supernova explode, assuming any model makes a supernova explode. This is another thing. But okay, this argument has now recently been countered by Romanino and others, and they've shown that actually the MSW effect is self-adjusting, that neutrinos evaporate until the potential is zero, and therefore the effect disappears. It's a cute paper they have made.
Who is this?
Well, I don't know the authors by name, but I remember Romanino as one. It's an interesting paper, I think. Well, maybe the effect is kind of dynamical, so it works for some parameters. It's fairly general, but not absolutely foolproof. Okay, so let me just come back to this. We have explored 3A, MSSM, and nothing added. 3B, we have mentioned something about those funny oscillation patterns, and now I want to come back to the CISO mechanism with an eye, we'll see later. I think this is the last time I'm using this slide, so I've numbered them for, okay. So, new right CISO. Well, the obvious question is, who has ever ordered ordered the new write. Because when we look at those models where you just add one new write, which is hanging somewhere, hovering somewhere in space at 10 to the 10 GeVs, 11, 9, whatever, well, we don't know where because we have no reason to put it there or another place, except from experimental data. So who has ordered that particle? Why do we need it? And of course, this is just motivation to go to SU2 write. Well, if we work in the standard model, we're just adding a singlet. This is just essentially that kind of universal seesaw mechanism we have mentioned. If we work in SU5, well, SU5 is 5 and 10 bar. This is not a simple representation. The anomalies happen to cancel between the two, but it's a pure accident in SU5. Well, if we didn't know it, we would have to spend some time calculating. And we add a singlet. Of course, the idea is that makes a 16 in SO10, which is also a member of E6. And essentially, the difference is that we, from the gauge point of view, one possible decomposition is that we have an SU2 write there. So I don't worry whether this SU2 write is really realized as a subgroup at any given energy. But certainly, for me, the only motivation for introducing the new write is to have this 16 representation, which is then working in a completely anomaly-free group, which is rather pleasant. And we don't have to worry about anomalies anymore. So whether this SU2 write is realized or not at some stage, I don't worry about it. But the associated bosons will certainly get a mass at some stage. And the mass tends to be related to the new write mass. Actually, the simplest breaking is giving essentially the same mass to the new write and the W write. If I'm not mistaken, it's the 120, but I've forgotten this kind of group arithmetic some time ago. So we get a mass for the right-handed neutrino, we get a mass for the right-handed W. And that means that if I don't do anything, once again, the mass of the fermion is similar to the mass of the boson. Is that a problem? Well, possibly so. This is a problem for dilution because, of course, the idea when we get this new right present is to use it for leptogenesis. And using the fact that it's a heavy particle, it can act as a relic particle and decay relatively slowly with respect to the expansion of the universe, decay with a lot of CP violating Majorana phases. I'm not going to discuss this. I think Evgeny went really at length through it, and we had a very nice talk on that, so I'm not going to say a word about it here. But we get this nice mechanism to generate a lepton number and later use phalerons to convert it, to exchange it, deal it at a scandalous rate, unfortunately, 1/2 or 1/3 against baryons. But once we have that, we must make sure on one hand that the particle, the new right, is indeed a kind of relic particle. That means it decays more slowly than the universe expands at that moment. And also that this CP violation in this decay is really significant. Even if we have only to account for 10 to the minus 10, we must get those 10 to the minus 10. Now, this happens usually because this decay here is very slow. This is a Yukawa coupling, which involves the left-handed scalar bosons, and we see that the typical scale there is a suppressed one. It is something like the mass of the electron divided by the mass of the W, or the mass, at worst, the mass of the tau divided by the mass of the W, order of magnitude. I'm not really discussing it for the moment. So we have a serious suppression here, and that means that this particle can be long-lived, and that's why we can bring its mass scale down to 10 to the minus 10, instead of the usual 10 to the minus 15 that we would need for a gauge particle to beat the expansion rate of the universe. But since this decay is suppressed, this one becomes dangerous. If I allow the new right to decay into a W right and a left right, a lepton, here I necessarily have the right-handed coupling, which is the gauge coupling of the same order as the other one, which is thus much larger than this coupling. And this decay turns out to be a total killer. So I as well forget about it. And I assume now that the W right is even minimally heavier than the new right. We'll assume that. In which case, which is not the usual assumption in left-right models, but okay, I will assume that. In which case, the next decay is this one, where we go to right-handed quarks. And this decay is certainly feasible. If we work it out, it's the usual formula for the muon decay. Yes, M5 over M4. And nothing secret with that. So what do we get? We get then a dilution. This is the usual result. One, this is the normal decay rate of the right-handed neutrino, plus this gauge decay rate. And when you work it out, it's trivial mathematics to work it out, you find that the mass of the right-handed neutrino over the W right has to be less than whatever your maximum dilution is allowed for, see Evgeny's talks, times this ratio of sum f of mdij. I is your, I should have put in, this is I is your Majorana neutrino, J is the Dirac ones, over MW length. Okay, let's take a worst case. Assume M1 is essentially linked to nu E, and the coupling here is the mass of the electron. This is what you usually do in the CSUM questions. You see that we need a suppression of 400 on the mass ratio, not the mass squared. 400 on the mass ratio, which is quite gigantic, a suppression. On the other hand, you are saving. On the other hand, you are saving because for your off equilibrium situation, you are saving because since your particle now, I'm saying it wrong here. We have worked out an example with one student, it was a while ago. And we have made assumption. We have taken some kind of typical matrix. I'm not no fan of textures, but assume a matrix like this, which is large mixing by having zero determinants. So I have zero me mu mu. So this determinant is zero and okay or near zero. If you work it out in this case, you find that if M1 related directly to this matrix is the lightest one, then the ratio to M over M neutrino of MW right has to be of order 10 to the minus 2. And the mass of the neutrino has to be 10 to the 7, bigger than 10 to the 7. This is a bit old numbers. They can be refined now. You do a lot better if your lightest Majorana particle is linked to the heavier light fermions. If M2 or M3 are the lightest particles, well, you have essentially no suppression in the game. And so during your talk, I was checking, and I think all the examples you had were working for this. But so you could safely, I think most cases, you could safely add, I'm referring to Evgeny's talk, you could safely add a right-handed sector. Okay, I have 20 minutes left. Now, this is optional. This is something you may not be terribly interested in, so I'll just go through essentially the titles. Not directly interested in because it has no direct bearing of neutrinos. But I've mentioned neutrinos in the talk already, Boris, haven't I? So I'm allowed a few minutes.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the next question is how to generate a mass pattern. Well, personally, I must say it, a profound dislike for textures. My dislike for textures comes from the fact that they are usually strongly basis dependent. Now, some studies have been made in a basis independent way, for example, showing that more than three zeros is a basis independent statement, but one or two zeros is not a basis independent statement, for example. So I don't like textures. Horizontal symmetries would be a nice choice. Unfortunately, very often the horizontal symmetries are quote natural unquote and naturally chosen to fit exactly the texture that you had dreamt of. So it's kind of a way to get back legal after the fact. And Also, the horizontal symmetries have only led to trouble, for example, in extended Technicolor. So, a relatively new idea has been to play with extra dimensions, and I will mention this. And a related question is how to generate CP. This is my pet subject, so I'll spend more time on this. I'll keep this slide for the moment. So, the game is topography of extra dimensions. A number of people have introduced that. I think Dimopoulos, I'm not sure, Arkani Ahmed, Branko has worked a lot on that, Mohapatra. Well, there is a number of people. You can find, I can give you the list of you can find references in the papers I'm using. So instead of having textures, you get a fifth dimension cartography. What you do is you have your fifth dimension. You localize your fermions in the fifth dimension by putting some domain wall, essentially, which is a topological defect, and by tuning this parameter M, which has nothing to do with the four-dimensional mass, you can locate your various fermions at different places in this fifth dimension. At that moment, imagine, for example, EL and E right are slightly separated in space. Since you make sure this is sharp enough, you can tune the slope, you make this sharp enough, then it's just the overlap which is giving you the mass of the electron. You have, of course, to introduce some scalar boson in the game, but this is just the overlap. And in a way, you are now transforming abscissi here, or small shifts in position in the extra dimension, into huge differences in masses. And this is what you need in some ways. You have a very hierarchical picture for the masses. Well, the problem with this picture is that it is...
What do you do with dimensional reduction? Of this?
Yes?
This mass will survive on dimension. M side also.
Well, no, this will not survive because this is, I can tell you, this is a link between left-handed and right-handed modes. If I see it from 3+1 dimensions, this is left-handed and right-handed modes. Essentially here, the left-handed modes are zero mass solution. The left-handed modes are captive of the domain wall. They are zero mass solution. They live here. While the right-handed modes are rejected to infinity if you work with non-confined dimensions, or are completely killed if you are working on an orbifold. So this is not seen in... this links a four-dimensional object, which is the psi left, to an object which is not observable in four dimensions, which is a psi right, which is not the E right. We can go through it if you want. Well, I want to go through the talk so we can come back to it in questions if you want. But this is not observed as a mass parameter in four dimensions. Okay. Now, what are we getting? Well, it's just now a matter of tuning those abscissi to get all the mixings you want, you dream of, all the masses you dream of. And of course, it's very sensitive, so you have the impression you don't do much tuning, just factor of two or something like that, and you get tremendous exponential factors. Well, okay, tuning the exponent is never very large, but this is what it amounts to, it's tuning the exponent. I'm not terribly impressed by this. The problem is that we have no predictive power because we are just mapping the thing as we want. And there is only one prediction actually which starts to come out, is if you have the gauge bosons. The gauge bosons have Kaluza-Klein excitations. I take the zero mode, the one I want to see. This is coupling equally to all those modes because the areas are equal. So life is fine. But the first excitation or the next excitations will fluctuate in sign over this dimension, and therefore I will first of all lose flavor universality for this Z prime, and I will also lose flavor changing suppression of flavor changing neutral currents. So you get both flavor changing neutral currents and non-universality, both of which could be observed at some future collider. You put the one you want. Depending on which advertisement you want to make. If you want to advertise for the next linear collider, you say, well, it would be too low, and you put the next linear collider there if you want, of your choice. I don't want to be involved in politics. Let's say it's optimistic for LHC. I think it would be commercial to say for Tevatron, but okay, why not? Now, we have worked on a somewhat more constrained scheme in this. Okay, I will have to run a little bit. And the idea is essentially the same. We are working with extra dimensions, but now instead of using one extra dimension, we go to the full expanse and we buy two more. So we put two extra spatial dimensions. The topological defect now, instead of being a domain wall, is a vortex. It has this structure, where n I have to choose. And winding n is the winding number. And the phi, the confining field, has this behavior. So my fermions are essentially constrained to live. The massless fermions will live in the center of this vortex. Now, there is an index theorem which tells me that if I have n there, I get n massless chiral solutions. And why would not n be 3? This is tuning, of course. I will tune it. 2, 4, 3, okay. I'll choose 3. And or you can choose a winding number 1 solution and cube it, which is a lot easier for from the group theory if you want to do, to build your model. And we will get 3, in this case, families. Now, the interesting case is that it's a little bit like the Adjutant atom. Those three families have to be orthogonal to each other. So they are orthogonal in theta space. That means they have different winding numbers. And they also have different R behavior, like the good old Adjutant atom. That means the first solution has winding number 0 and drops from the origin. The next one raises linearly, the third one raises quadratically. Now we have no freedom. Well, we have a little bit of freedom in adjusting those scales, but the overlaps are essentially determined. And in this way, you can make, first of all, what you get immediately is that the mass terms are diagonal, and that's the selection rule due to this theta term, right? Now you can build the extra term here by just putting one more scalar field which has winding number 1. You get this one. If you want to put that one, you would have to put winding number 2 field, which you don't want to put in, so you can get the kind of mass matrix you want. The game is constrained. It is working, and Troitsky, Lebanov, and Nugiev have been working on further on this, and they have some examples. For the moment, we are building more on this. We have done some first attempts with neutrinos, but we are not, there is a paper on it, but we are not satisfied with it. I can tell you why later. One interesting thing here is that the first Z prime has winding number 1. And as a result, if you neglect the small off-axis elements of the matrix, you see that it is not flavor changing, because it's E into mu gives a Z prime, which goes in, again into mu into E. Except it is flavor changing, because you can do it for the quarks. And then your first signal is KL into mu bar E, which is something to look for. And the limits there are, well, if you look at the numbers in the table, you see are of the order of 100 TeVs. But that means tabletop experiments are certainly interesting for this. We have embedded news in this. It can be done. You can play the game having the new write in the bulk. But to do that properly, you need, instead of working in the plane, you need to compactify the thing on the sphere, where the singularity then appears like a monopole sitting at the center of the sphere. This is what we are currently doing, and we have not gone further in this thing. Okay. Now, this was for the extra dim and CP violation. I have 5 minutes left. I'll just flash this. Okay. CP, because I have another subject to mention, two other subjects to mention. CP violation in fundamental theories. Well, it's very difficult, because if you want to get a fundamental theory, you want to get rid of your Yukawa couplings, or at least you want to relate it to the gauge couplings. The gauge couplings are not CP violating. So how in hell would your Yukawa couplings be CP violating if you get from a fundamental theory? So there are only two ways I know of. One is, you could use anomalies, but it's a bit the same game. One is possibility to have tumbling condensates, all tumbling theories, Lasserskind, that you get successive condensates or vacuum expectation values building, and we know from the work of T.D. Lee that you need to have at least three of those condensates to get a non-trivial phase. Otherwise, the minimum is always when the phases are back-to-back or completely aligned. This is one possibility. It's a bit contrived, but certainly is a possibility. Another possibility we have worked on recently with two students, Laura Lopez and Nicola Cosn, is to get it from extra dimensions. And there we can discuss it, but essentially what is happening, let's take again a five-dimensional theory. I put here some mass term. Again, we will see that this not exactly appearing as a mass term in lower dimensions, but if I do this, you see that my gauge theory is written like this, where B goes from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, interestingly, and there is a lot of discussion about P parity, this term is actually P odd. This term is actually P odd. We could discuss that sometime. But the gamma 4 is actually I gamma 5. Okay? Which means that the left-handed and the right-handed components are mixed by gamma 4. So when I reduce from 5 to 4, if I singularize out, I should have put gamma 4 here. Right, it get, well, this, I should really change a lot of things here. 4 and P, okay? If my gamma 4 has a vacuum expectation value, I could treat it as a scalar field, and it could get a vacuum expectation value giving a complex part to the mass. Now, this is with only one fermion. I could rotate that away, but at least I get a complex part. Well, it is not exactly that simple. I'm going fast on this. It's not exactly that simple because the vacuum expectation value of a gauge field is not a gauge invariant notion locally. So, but I need to integrate over y to get rid of y, the fifth component, fifth dimension anyway. So this might be gauge invariant if I go from minus infinity to plus infinity, or if I go on a compact dimension, in which case I get a Wilson loop, and this is known as the Hosotani mechanism. And this Wilson loop is gauge invariant. You can think of it as the flux of a B field in the in existing area of this loop. You would to embed in 6 to see the flux. So this is a physically relevant quantity, and indeed we can get a complex mass. Now, if we want to go through that, this is my last slide on this. I will put back my microphone. We can get a complex mass for one fermion. Of course, that can be rotated away. But if we involve the internal group now, we can involve different complex masses for different fermions and indeed generate CP violation. We have a toy example with this U2 where we generate an electric dipole moment, and we have worked out how to embed this in a larger theory. And interestingly enough, you cannot do it into SO10, you need SO11 as a solution. It's something like it. It's something like it. I could not be completely affirmative about that. But. Okay. Well, you deserve, well, I've 3 more minutes. I'll need 5. But as a compensation, I'll have fun for 2. Okay? So I wanted to speak about neutrino astronomy, and for neutrino astronomy, of course, you've all heard about wrongly advertised neutrino telescopes, because who has ever seen a telescope without a mirror or a lens? Well, in French, it's different. The telescope has necessarily a mirror and no lens, but in English, you can use the game. So you could have a refractor and call that a telescope. So can we get a real neutrino telescope? Well, neutrinos are just like any particle. They are subject to the effect of general relativity, and therefore they will be deflected by any big mass. Think of the sun, for example, here. Now, if you think of photons and of the gravitational effect on photons around the sun, assuming that you are working through a total eclipse, and okay, this is really an awful lens, because the further away you get from the sun, the less deflection you get. And therefore, it's maybe a very good lens, but not a converging one, and you get your energy spread over the whole axis. So there is no gain. So is the sun a bad lens? Not really. Not really for neutrinos. Because neutrinos, if they are less than, I had to check the numbers on the GVs, would gladly go through the sun. After all, a lot of neutrinos come from us, they are MEVs, those ones. And if they go through the sun, actually you see this kind of Gauss's theorem, that the deflection increases when you go from the center. And you can work out a number of profiles and see how good lenses they are. And it turns out that you focus indeed your neutrinos, so you can get a huge enhancement. Imagine you focus on your neutrino detector, which is one square kilometer here, and you have here the area of the sun as an aperture. This is quite a telescope, right? Well, yes and no. Yes, it works. It's a good lens. But if you think the South Pole is far, you have to go to Uranus to do it. So it may be a nice project for Francis for the next time, but...
spacecraft.
But that's a function of energy, right?
Not so much, no.
No? So what determines the...
Well, you just take the mass of the sun, and it's like the deflection of photons.
What is the index of refraction?
There's no refraction. No. Oh, sorry, sir.
Suppose that the sun had a uniform density equal to its maximum density at the center.
Yeah. Oh, the index, the...
Well, what is just the index?
The MSW.
Yes.
Is negligible.
Totally negligible.
Yeah, negligible. Well, if you are at high enough energy, it's negligible.
MEV
have not worked out, but at GV scale, it's completely. We have thought of that. It's not the leading effect. Well, there is still one possibility if you don't want to go to Uranus, but that's contrived and maybe it's source for thought for some astronomers. But I doubt it. Yeah. Is to have a lighthouse. You put a compact object, which is a new source. You put a big star next to it, and you get a lighthouse. Yeah, for example.
Well, a supernova with a big companion binary.
Well, we have worked out a number of other examples, like how it goes with galaxies. And there was a paper on the web 2 days ago where people looked for departure from standard gravity with the putting two things together. That's the usual thing, you know. If you want to observe a five-legged sheep, it's not very common, but it's a bit tedious to observe, you can do it. Now, if you think the job is too hard, you can ask that it should be red in the same time. It makes the job a lot easier. And if you are concerned with background, you go in a desert where you have minimal background. So if you start looking for five-legged red sheep in the desert, it's a possibility. I'm not sure you get funding.
I don't think so.
Okay, just to mention this, this is just the end, it's just the beginning of a discussion. Current work. Well, I'm old enough to be setting some ambitious goals. In a way, I'm very frustrated. This is just ongoing work, no results. I'm very frustrated because we know all about Cecilia determinants. And the frustrating thing is those things are obtained mathematically. You take matrices, you combine them, you take traces, you get the answer, and you say, that's the only way I can get CP violation. No, it has to be that. But you'd never see it come out of a graph. I've never seen it come out of a graph. I know Cecilia has also tried to do that, and she told me she had not succeeded. And I guess if she had, it would be published. So it might actually be easier in neutrinos than in quarks, because quarks you get a lot of complications coming. So I've tried to work out a very simple example, and it's a bit amusing. So if you want to see CP violation here, for example, nu mu to nu e could be different from nu bar into nu e bar. And I will qualify that later. It is certainly one of the searches for CP violation, I'm almost done. I can think of this as unitarity diagrams. This was before my time, where we had Katkowski rules and so on, but it's still useful. You can think of this as a muon decaying into a neutrino, later producing an electron in a detector. Or you can think of this as a diagram, a closed diagram, in a W background, which you don't care about. Assume we have all the W's you need to provide energy and momentum. And this process then amounts to doing a unitarity cut here, which means taking the Hermitian conjugate of the left side. That's a way of calculating the lifetime or the cross-section of a process. And that's the advantage. This is very systematic, and you don't lose terms. This is why this formalism is being used extensively, actually, when it comes to leptogenesis or baryogenesis. If you try to do this and try to compute to third order, well, to the order mm dagger cube, m is the Dirac matrix. If you try to work to mm dagger cube, where we know there is an effect, okay, the effect has been calculated and we know it. If we work to this order, just expanding the propagator as a bare term plus an mm dagger plus and so on and so on, I could put some token mass there if I'm afraid of infrared divergences, but that's not the question. What I get when I do the calculation is the sum of those two terms. And it's very quick to check that this quantity is real, and therefore that I don't get CP violation in this channel, which is strange because I know I do. On the other hand, I know that the same channel would be contributing to mu to E gamma. It is essentially the same diagram. And I know that if I wanted to have mu to E gamma different from mu bar to E bar gamma, I would need to have some compensation somewhere, because otherwise that would imply that the mu and mu bar don't have the same lifetime, which is not allowed by CPT. And I would get the CPT police against me. So this guarantees me that I don't get it. But that means that the calculation has to be done somewhat differently when I go through neutrino oscillations. And indeed, if you look at what happens, I remind you, I had to take back Diagrammar from, which is an interesting paper written by Toft and Veltman. When you do those Katkowski rules, there is a slight change when you go from the left to the right. You have a minus I epsilon here and a plus I epsilon here. You can think of it as a strong phase is changing in a CP setting. That means that if you are on...
Where does this come from?
It's just the standard Katkowski rules. When you do the cut, huh? You have the shadow part of the cut. I recheck in Diagrammar. This is only important, of course, if those things are on shell. Now, if I go to configuration space, this means that here, indeed, I have E minus IPX, which is the on-shell propagation, and here I have EIPX, which is giving E minus IM squared L over 2E, and so on. If I develop the thing now, what I'm getting exactly the same the result as previously with a minus sign, because I have to expand first and second order here, first and second order there, and there will be a sign difference. And this gives me exactly and immediately the result I want, which is the usual area of the triangle times the product of the mass differences. And this is, of course, similar to the result, which I recalculated quickly, which is the exact result is something like, imagine you're the same thing, times the product of the signs of the delta m squared over 4 in the thing. So it is not quite exactly the Cecilia-Jarlskog determinant, but it's coming close. And this is, okay, I don't know whether I can go much further, but it's to show that it's a bit tricky. And actually what happens if you want in this game, in some way the cancellation happens not between various channels, but in time dependence. And if I get the probability of transition of neutrinos, it is essentially going like this. And so the cancellation is between this and this. And this is a time-dependent or an x-dependent effect, which cannot be seen in a momentum space. But this is part of a much more ambitious program of trying to phrase in an invariant way the CP violation. Okay, sorry, I was a bit longer than expected.
Questions or comments?
Okay. I have a question, not just to Jean-Marie, maybe to everybody. There's one thing in CP violation which I have in Aquinas, which I never understood. If I compare the Gaussian invariant of force in mechanics, you see that in the case of leptons, there is not dependent on the charge that we masses. In the case of forks, there are differences of the masses of both uprights and downrights.
Yeah, okay, I can answer you on this. Well, I can give you part of an answer on this. Let me go back to this. Indeed, this applies, this is exactly the same as quarks and, for quarks and leptons, because the Majorana matrix does not appear, right? The Majorana phases don't appear. They don't appear because I'm dealing with left-handed couplings here, so I've always to come back to the left-handed coupling, so I only get the KM matrix in the game. Actually, MM dagger all the time. So this is essentially the same as quarks. And for quarks, we know that we have to observe a non-trivial mixing between the up and the down quarks. And of course, if all the up quarks were degenerate, then I could rotate away all that mixing and I cannot see anything. So in a way, my system has to know that the top quarks are not degenerate, or here, not the top quarks, but the down leptons, if you prefer, are non-degenerate. And this is actually the problem with the Jarlskog determinant, is that when you work out the full determinant, it has indeed the product of all the charged leptons, so up of minus C, down minus S, difference of mass squared. You have six of them.
I suspect that what's going on is that when one does the usual analysis mm-hmm. of neutrino oscillation, one begins by defining Clebier neutrinos with reference to the charged leptons in association with which they are produced or detected. You've already cranked in that there's a difference between the charged lepton masses, which enables you to make this definition. If that charged lepton mass difference went away, you couldn't write down the formalism to begin with.
But it is here. Essentially, you have specified explicitly that you started with a muon and that you ended up with an electron.
That's quite clear.
That is put in your...
Why do the charged leptons masses not enter explicitly in the expression for the Jarlskog invariant?
No. This is not the Jarlskog invariant. It is not the Jarlskog invariant which is coming. That's part of the frustration. Indeed, if you were doing something different, let me imagine that I'm suppressing the indices here. Okay, I'm suppressing this. And I'm summing over all leptons. Then I would get zero in this way. Unless I put in evidence
of course you
the mass.
Any mixing at all if the charged lepton masses are degenerate. That's clear.
Yeah.
My question was more kind of formal.
No, but in answer.
May I say something that's going to make your question even more difficult? But it may point to what the nub of the problem is here. If you do quark physics, if you do the analysis, the standard analysis of CP violation in B events, no quark masses, up type or down quark, or down type, enter, nothing. Now, I'm sure that's because in doing the analysis, one has already fed into the problem the fact that the up quarks are not degenerate and the fact that the down quarks are not degenerate. And I at least have not seen anybody do an analysis which leaves the mass splittings as a parameter.
In B physics,
really the observables are not directly expressible in terms of the Jarlskog invariant.
The CP violating observables in BDK.
I think you
are not written in such a way that you know what their relation to the Jarlskog invariant is. They talk about the angles in the unitary triangle, not the area of this triangle. Now, you know perfectly, we all know that got to be expressible in terms of the Jarlskog invariant, but the way the formalism, it's a very good question, actually. I've also felt uncomfortable about this
Yeah, this is exactly the question we have. And here, if you want, the part of the neutrino is explicit. I think this is one of the cases. You know, this is completely toy. It's simplistic calculation, but it is one of the cases where you come closest to having the Jarlskog determinant. If you were to sum in some way or weigh in some way on all the charge leptons, probably you would get the whole thing appear. But we are, in a way, it's kind of myopia we have. With our equipment, we tend to think that the mu is something very different from the electron, and therefore we distinguish them explicitly instead of considering them as two states of charge leptons. And so it's built in the calculation. In the same way, if you do CP violation in the K system, the epsilon, for example, you divide by the KK bar mass difference, so you are dividing by a part of the Jarlskog determinant also there. In B physics, as Boris said, not only do you know you are in B physics from the start, but you also end up with C quarks when you do the J psi, so you are also identifying the up quarks in the end in the game. And now here, if you look, by taking two different leptons and identifying them, you see that the three kinds of charged leptons are different. So you have it is indeed here. But I'd love to go one step further. Maybe I just like the abstraction capacity.
There was a fairly simple way of cleaning this up. I think, although we're all confident we know how it has to work, it would be nice to see it actually working that way. I mean, that's basically.
And I'm not convinced that we have. I'm not convinced that we have exhausted all the CP violation channels. For the moment, it's just enumeration that people have listed. Oh yes, in this case, well, yeah, there will be CP violation. I worked 2 weeks on it, but I won't tell you. It's obvious there will be in this channel. It is something like that, you know, that we have all kinds of recipes for finding CP violation, but no exhaustive system. I'm sorry, I'm.
Other questions, comments?
Actually, one more question. Maybe it's for
the. Oh, your option.
We're here to discuss this, just a very short one. Coming back to the idea of neutrinos and axial dimensions. So, what we usually get is the kind of a Dirac type mass term for neutrinos, and we just get a very simple and natural explanation why it should be small, unlike in the usual situation. Now, since we introduced these singlet neutrinos, and they are singlets, nobody prevents us from introducing Majorana mass term for them. Mm-hmm. And we will have some seesaw whether we want it or not in this case. But the seesaw of a very strange kind, because these singlet neutrinos most likely will have mass of the T in scale, which is the scale of this axial dimension. So what would happen in this case? Would you get a very big mass for usual light?
Well, the way to introduce Majorana mass is I have to think a little bit of how to do it, because you could, of course, do it by symmetry breaking. But, for example, in five dimensions, I don't think you have Majorana neutrinos.
Yeah, but in some numbers of actually.
Oh, of course, you can go higher. You can go higher.
After you come back to the.
If you come back to the, yeah, but
yeah, but because they are singlets, nobody prevents
that. Yeah, but that probably has to be introduced by symmetry breaking, because in five you cannot do it, so it has to go through the symmetry breaking mechanism, either of the group or of the dimensional reduction. Specifically 5 to 4. If you start in 6, you can build Majorana terms, but they are pretty different because they play with different games.
If there are no further questions, let's thank Jean-Marie again. Thank you.